turning our attention to Paul's opening statement in his first letter that to the Galatians. We've spent considerable time analyzing the initial statement that he made, as well as the context of this statement, which was written somewhere around 50 CE, about 17 years after Yosha fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuah in year 4000 Yah, which was 33 CE. This was written in response to the Jerusalem summit, which occurred right around 50 CE, to bring Paul in to accuse him for being a fraud and for contradicting the Torah. At the time, Paul was a murderer by his own admission. He was out hunting down and killing those who followed Yosha, Torah observant Yehudim, Yisraelites, who had responded to Yahusha. It was Paul's, at the direction he claims of the rabbinical community, to hunt them down and kill them. Now, as in the context of Rome, that claim is baseless. If Paul took it upon himself to kill anyone in the Roman province of Yehuda, he would be breaking the law. Romans retained the authority to implement capital punishment. That's why when the Sanhedrin met, which was comprised, you know, of a lot of rabbis, when the Sanhedrin met to because they wanted to do away with Yahusha, because he was so opposed to the religious establishment and the political establishment, they had to take him to Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor at the time, to kill him, because they did not have the authority. And so since the Sanhedrin didn't have the authority, it is absolutely certain that a Jewish rabbi would not have had the authority to kill anyone. So Paul's whole premise that he was out murdering Christians, but really followers of the way, as a tough guy, is one of his many lies. But he claims he was out doing that, and then he saw this vision on the road to Damascus, this flashing light, which he doesn't know if anybody else saw or not. And he heard this voice, which he doesn't know if anyone heard or not, and this voice cites Dionysus, and that according to Paul, this becomes his announcement that he is an apostle. Even though Yosha said, if anybody claims to see me before the whole world sees me collectively, they are a liar, do not follow them. Nonetheless, against everything Yosha said, against everything that that can be gleaned from history, Paul nonetheless writes, Paulos, of Latin origin meaning lowly and little, an apostle, a Greek word, which means prepared as a delegate who is dispatched. Not from men, not even by means of man, but to the contrary, on behalf of Iesu Christu and God, Father of the one having roused and awakened him out of a lifeless corpse. Galatians 1:1. Now, this is interesting indeed, telling, because this man, born as Shaul, would choose to rename himself, disgorging his Hebrew inheritance in the process. The language of God's revelation was rejected to select a Latin nom de plume. Shaul, now Paulos, was thereby estranging himself from Yahweh's testimony while reflecting his allegiance to Rome, to mankind's most powerful kingdom, and to the very beast of Daniel. In fact, Rome is presented in the Daniel prophecies as the most savage, the most all-encompassing, the most vicious, the most deadly and destructive beast humankind had ever known and would ever know. But Paul is showing his allegiance to Rome. There was no place on earth more overtly religious, more aggressively political, more aggressively militaristic, or more wealth-driven than Rome. at this moment, no other nation was more morally corrupt or ruthlessly oppressive. This change in identity alone should have been sufficient to motivate readers to Shaul, question him. Now, this opening line affirms that Paulos, as he now chose to be known, wanted his audience to believe that he was an apostle, capital A, and thus was on the same footing as Yahusha's disciples. He said that he had been apostolos, prepared and placed as a delegate and messenger of Iesu Christu. Now, it is interesting, of course, that the Messiah, Yahusha, correct title, correct name, said no such thing. The title of apostle was not given to Shaul or to Paulos by Yahweh either. In fact, rather than speaking for God, God said that Shaul spoke presumptuously and deceitfully. Paulos' claim that his message was unrelated to any man or to men is also untrue. He, by his own admission, was trained to be a rabbi. And this, like every letter Paulos would write, reads exactly like the Talmud, which is a collection of rabbinical arguments regarding the Torah. All of Paul's letters read just like the Talmud. They're Paul's arguments regarding the Torah. It should also be noted that even if he had correctly written the Messiah Yahusha, in reality, the corporeal manifestation of God didn't speak for himself. He spoke for Yahweh. So not only does Paulos have his name and title reversed, he has upended Yahusha's relationship with Yahweh. And this is no Paulos small mistake. Yahusha did not convey his own message. His words were not his own. According to Yahweh, Yahusha is his mouth, the living embodiment of his words. Yahusha came in Yahweh's name to communicate and affirm Yahweh's message. So to invent or invert Yahusha's relationship with Yahweh in this way is to circumvent his purpose. But more than all of this, we will speak more additionally about these divine placeholders that were used in this text. Beyond this now, God did not die. God cannot die. Yahusha did not fall asleep. And with absolute certainty, we know that Yahusha's corpse was not resurrected. So all of this is a lie, and that it is wholly inconsistent with Yahweh's teaching and prophecy on this subject. Let me explain. Yahusha represented the perfect Passover lamb moments before his physical body was sacrificed on our behalf as the Pesach lamb. Yahweh's spirit left him. That is one of the reasons he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? The other reason, of course, was to direct our attention to the 22nd Mizmor, or Psalm, so that we might understand what was occurring. Rather than dying, Yahusha's soul descended into Sheol, the place of separation from God, on the Mikra of Matzah, which began at that very moment, which is known as unleavened bread. To remove the fungus of sin, particularly religious and political, rebellion against God, from us. It was the most horrid experience imaginable. It was hardly a snooze. At this time, his corpse was incinerated, ceasing to exist in complete harmony with the Torah's instructions regarding the Passover lamb. Then on the Mikra of Bukurim, known as first fruits, or more accurately, firstborn children, Yahusha's soul was reunited with Yahweh's spirit, becoming the firstborn of the covenant, thereby fulfilling the Torah's promise to adopt us. Further, as evidence that his corpse was not awakened, not raised, not reanimated, nor resurrected, The only common denominator, and we talked about this with Kirk at the end of our program yesterday, amongst the three eyewitness accounts that same day was that no one recognized him, including those closest to him. Moreover, if he arose from a corpse, he would have been disqualified as the Passover lamb, because according to the Torah in Shemoth Names, Exodus 12:10, the remainder of the lamb's body had to be incinerated that evening. So in his opening statement, Paul got everything wrong. His name, his title, his status, his sponsor, Yahusha's title, Yahusha's name, as well as the relationship between Yahweh and Yahusha, all while promoting the myth that God died, fell asleep on the job, and was bodily resurrected from a corpse. It's not an auspicious beginning for the founder of the Christian religion. Whether or not each of the accusations that I've laid before you prove to be valid will be determined in due time, as that is the entire purpose of this presentation. But it is especially telling to note that Shaul didn't say, at least in his opening line, that he was speaking for God the Father. That's a subtlety lost on most Christians who have replaced Yahweh with their Lord Jesus Christ, in effect, focusing on the implement as opposed to the one wielding it. This issue isn't insignificant. While Yahusha came from Yahweh, they are not equivalent. Yahusha cannot be equal to Yahweh because Yahusha, by his own admission and by necessity, is the diminished manifestation of Yahweh. All of God cannot fit into a human form, and the undiminished presence of God would consume our planet. This concept was affirmed by Yahusha when he acknowledged, "The Father is greater than I am." It can be found in Yahochanan, which means Yahweh is merciful, John 14:28. We will also consider this from the perspective of Einstein's most famous equation, E equals MC squared, when we return after the commercial break. Einstein's most famous equation, maybe the most famous equation in the world, is E equals MC squared. Most people don't know what that means, but it's not complicated. E stands for energy. Energy equals mass times the speed of light times the speed of light. So energy is equivalent to mass or to matter. But energy isn't equal to mass or matter until you increase the amount of mass by multiplying it by the speed of light times the speed of light. Which means that energy is a lot more than is matter. The same amount of energy and matter, you have to multiply the matter by the speed of light squared to be equivalent to energy. So when Yahusha is set apart from Yahweh, Yahweh equates himself to light. Light is energy. Yahusha is corporeal, physical form. So when Yahweh takes part of his energetic light nature and translates that into matter, the matter has to be that portion that he has translated has to be to the speed of light times the speed of light less than the amount of energy that was actually set apart to comprise him. So it's not just that, you know, that Yahusha is a lot less than Yahweh, and you ought not be referring to Yahusha. You know, you ought not say, "I am speaking for Yahusha." You ought not be saying that, much less Iesu Christu. Because Iesu Christu, Yahusha, the Messiah Yahusha, is a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of Yahweh. He isn't separate from Yahweh. There is no Yahusha and the Father. They're one and the same. It's just that they aren't equal. They aren't even remotely equal. They're the speed of light times the speed of light. I mean, something that moves so quickly. I think it's when you look at the 186,000 miles a second at the speed of light, that a photon of light, if it would actually bend around the Earth, in a second's time would travel around the circumference of the Earth, and I don't know what the number is, but it's like 6, 7, 8, 10 times. I mean, that's how fast light is. 186,000 miles a second. Unfathomable in terms of its the magnitude of it. You have to multiply that times itself for this energy to be equivalent to, or mass to be equivalent to energy. I've used the example that if you wanted to compare Yahusha to Yahweh, it would be like comparing a man's toenail clipping to the man. And I've said that while that might sound like, you know, the toenail clipping is an insignificant part of the man, it's not nearly as extreme as reality. Yahusha is far less equal to Yahweh than is the toenail clipping to the individual from which it came. I'm not disparaging Yahusha, because I recognize that all Yahusha is the diminished corporeal manifestation of Yahweh. And once you come to realize that, you always look past Yahusha. You look through Yahusha. If you want to know Yahusha, simply listen to Yahweh's words. That's all he is. If you want to understand Yahusha, read the Torah. He is the living representation of the Torah. He is the Torah. Fulfilled and be in our presence. But the idea that you're going to establish a religion and speak on behalf of the toenail clipping is stupid. And that's basically, you know, Christians are praying to the toenail clipping by the wrong name. Just not thinking. And that's the problem, one of many problems, that's expressed with Paul's initial statement. You know, E equals MC squared. Since Yahweh is spirit and describes himself as light, he is energy. Yahusha, as a man, was corporeal and thus matter. Einstein's formula reveals that energy and matter are exactly the same thing, which means there's no Trinity here. There's no second person of the Trinity. But they are not equivalent. He proved that matter is a substantially diminished form of energy. If the human manifestation of God was equal to God, what's known as the Lord's misname, prayer, would become nonsensical. It would have Yahusha saying, "Pray to me who is in heaven, set apart is my name, my kingdom come, my will be done." He didn't say that. So now, with the Son having returned to the Father, it's curious that Paul himself is representing the representative who is no longer here. That's silly, unless he's claiming to be the Messiah himself. The express purpose of this introduction from Shaul's perspective was conveyed by the unification of the first two words, the amalgamation of his new name and title, Paulos, Apostle. It is a distinction he bequeathed upon himself, because Yahusha's disciples refused to convey it on him. For Paulos, it was essential that he be seen as Yahusha's apostle, even though it was a title he did not earn and was never given. The Greek word that we transliterate apostle, apostolos, when used correctly, is an extraordinarily important and revealing concept, although you have to be careful, because God does not speak Greek. Yahusha did not speak Greek. And if you're transliterating a Greek word like apostolos as apostle, you're creating a title based on a foreign language that was never revealed by God. So there is no godly term apostle. But there is a concept about being set apart. In Hebrew, the Hebrew word for set apart prepared and equipped. To be set apart in Hebrew is to be Kodesh. There are lots of things that are Kodesh in Hebrew. The Shabbat is Kodesh, means it's special from the other days, set apart from the other days of the week. The seventh day is. Yahweh's name is Kodesh. It's set apart. It's special from all other names. Yisrael is set apart, Kodesh. The Yisraelites and Yehudim are set apart, special, a people special to God. The seven annual meetings, or Moed Mikre, where we are invited to meet with God, they are set apart unto Yahweh. The covenant is set apart unto Yahweh. The most important thing that is set apart unto Yahweh is the set-apart spirit. She is literally the Ruach Kodesh, or spirit, who is set apart. Yahusha, according to Yahweh, is actually Kodesh Kodesh, set apart, set apart. So the concept of set apart is very important in Hebrew. It's apo in Greek, and it's Kodesh in Hebrew. There are lots of Hebrew words for prepared, set apart, equipped to serve. But they're not used in this context. So just be careful when you use the term apostle and try to say if somebody was and wasn't an apostle. It's a Greek word and a title that's been transliterated, which means to replicate the sound of the Greek. And yet there is no Greek distinction of any kind relative to God. Now, Apollos was a misguided soul. Even today, far too individuals go off as witnesses without first studying the Torah and prophets. And to be an apostelos, by the Greek definition, you would have to be stelos, which means prepared. Apo is the set apart, but the stelos aspect of it is prepared, equipped, taught, learned. And so the big issue with so many is that they go off, but they aren't properly prepared. They don't know what the Torah says, and therefore they do more harm than good. By changing his name and misappropriating his title, the opening line of Shaul's first letter became inaccurate in multiple ways. Those who know Yahweh, and thus Yahusha, recognize this, as did those during the day. They also recognized it. Shimon Kefesh knew it to be that Paul was a false prophet. Yahochanan did. They recognized that Shaul was not an apostle, and that there would never be a Roman serving in this role. Yahweh calls Rome the worst, most deadly and vicious and destructive beast that humanity would ever witness. And Yahweh is really clear in his presentation of Rome and of Romans in Daniel, which is we transliterate to Daniel 7, 8, and 9. He doesn't just say that Rome is unique amongst human empires, and that the uniqueness of Rome among human empires is that it was the most vicious, that it was the most deadly, that it was the most corrupt. He goes way beyond that. He says the thing about Rome is that it never died. That Rome continues to influence. And in the case of Rome, it's not like Babylon. It's not like Persia. It's not like the Greek Empire of Alexander the Great. The thing about Rome is that not only did it never die, but that it influences in a very negative way the whole world, according to God's prophetic testimony in Daniel 7, 8, and 9. Now, Rome itself, as a Roman Empire, was destroyed when Rome was sacked. The 5th century CE. And the Eastern Roman Empire, which did not, by the way, refer to itself as the Byzantine Empire, that was a very late, like 18th century designation. But the Eastern Roman Empire, which was wholly disassociated really after a while from the city of Rome, because the city of Rome was then sacked two more times, being obliterated essentially. That the Eastern empire itself was destroyed. It was the Muslims. You know, Islam was conceived by Muhammad around 610 CE. And shortly after Muhammad created Islam, Islam became the most vicious, barbarian entity in the world. And they ultimately destroyed Constantinople, turning it into Istanbul. Rome's gone as a empire. First sawed in half with half destroyed, then the second half was destroyed. But for God to say that it continues, that means that that which was Rome is manifest, has manifest itself out of Rome in a different way. And what you have is the only one candidate for that is Roman Orthodox and Roman Catholic Church. And that is the only possible answer for that which continues to be vicious and deadly and damning that grew out of Rome, that still exists and that permeates and influences the entire world. So by associating himself with Rome, he's not only associating himself with the deadliest beast that ever existed, a beast that was within years of this time, within, you know, 20 years of this time, less than that actually, 15 to 20 years of this time, would viciously attack Jerusalem and Israel, and would do so again shortly thereafter, 70 years thereafter, completely destroying Israel and Jerusalem. That not only was this beast anti-Torah and anti-Yehudim and anti-circumcision and anti-everything that God stood for. So associating with the beast at this time, there's nothing worse that Paul could have done in terms of his credibility, at least with God. But that beast would continue to live as Roman Catholicism because of this man. This Roman, Paul, he is the man responsible for the transformation of the beast from empire to church. He's the founder of the Roman Catholic Church. This is a horrible realization. And I want to tell you, folks, you can think and study until the cows come home about any other possibility for Rome continuing to exist right through the end of time and affecting the world as the world's most deadly and counterproductive, destructive beast. And there isn't any alternative other than the Roman Catholic and the Eastern Orthodox Church. And when you boil it all down, that comes to the feet of one man, one Roman, Paulus. And I can give you a lifetime to come up with viable alternatives, and you can't come up with one for either. So by changing his name and to a Roman one, misappropriating his title, the opening line of Shaul's first letter is inaccurate in every possible way. There is no chance that Yahweh, who condemned in every possible way the Roman Empire, would have a Roman advance his testimony. None. Rome was the ultimate beast. What's Paul's most famous letter? Romans. What does Paul write in the 13th chapter of his most famous letter? That you should submit to and obey the government. What was the government? Of every place that he ever traveled and talked to, Rome. And he says that the government is appointed by God, that the government is put there by God, that the government is to be obeyed. And the government was Rome, the very beast that was just a matter of 15 years from destroying Yahweh's temple, murdering hundreds of thousands of his children. And that was about 80 years from salting the ground, from murdering and enslaving every Jew, for destroying everything in Yehuda. And yet he says, that's a government that is good, that is doing good work for you, that you should submit to. There is no disassociating Paul from Rome. There is no disassociating Paul from the most deadly beast ever presented in Yahweh's prophetic testimony. Every one of Yahweh's prophets was a direct descendant of Abraham. And they were introduced using Hebrew names, every single one. Except, well, you can't say except Shaul, because he didn't speak for Yahweh. Further, Shaul did not walk in Yahusha's footsteps. He did not personally witness his fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, Bokurim, or Shavuah. He was not there in person in the upper room when the set-apart spirit descended upon those Yahusha had called out on the Mikra of Shavuah. No, he had no contact whatsoever with God. But he did have a lot of contact with HaSatan. And we'll talk about that in the final segment of Shattering Myths when we return. If you look at the meaning of the Greek word for apostle, apostello, there were only 12 by any rational definition of the word. All were chosen by Yahusha. All 12 lived with him and witnessed his every word and deed over a period of 3 years. And that is why he referred to them. He's translated referring to them under using disciples, which is another word that is transliterated out of the Greek. It means those willing to learn. The Hebrew word for, in fact, there's so many Hebrew words for learning and understanding and knowing, you know, those who know are yada. Those who understand are bien. And there's a lot of words in between that speak of teaching. For example, the most prevalent Hebrew word for teaching is Torah. So it's really interesting here that, you know, when he uses the term, when he's translated using the term disciple, which means to be taught, taught ones, if you will, Torah means to teach. So it's very possible that Yahusha would have referred to the 12 that are considered disciples because of our fascination with the Greek as actually being Torahs. They were Torahs. Now, from Paul's introduction, we know, and as well as from the introductions Paul wrote to the Corinthians, to the Romans, to the Colossians, and to the Ephesians, we know that Shaul coveted the title apostle. And it was one that Yahweh's Torahs, if you will, his disciples, were unwilling to give him. And yet so all-consuming was Paul's craving to be seen as important, to be seen as credible. He arrogantly and presumptuously overstepped his bounds. He knew that every word of his introduction was a lie. But it's one he would constantly repeat over and over again. And you know, sometimes if you lie repetitively enough, you will fool a lot of people. And if you get people that you fool to repeat your lies, well, you know, you can create a business out of that. Additionally, one of the reasons that we know that Paulos intended to convey apostle as a title rather than use apostelos as a descriptive term is that in his letters to Rome and to Corinth, he writes, Paulos called an apostle. The men and women he fooled called him by the title he craved. The Apostle Paul. And that Paul claimed to speak in the title and name of the Messiah Yahusha, even though he reversed the title and name, making them like Iusu's last name was Christu. We are compelled to consider his statement in the light of Devarim words, Deuteronomy 13 and 18, both of which places, Yahweh provides tests. These are tests established by Yahweh himself as God, so that his children could evaluate whether or not he actually inspired the words of someone claiming to speak for him. So, you know, if you're wondering, is this person speaking for God or not? God himself provided the test. You know, it's not my place to determine whether or not Paul lied when he claimed to speak for God. God provided the test. All we have to do is apply what Paul said to God's test, and you will know for certain, with absolutely no question whatsoever, as to whether or not Paul was actually speaking for God. God provided us with two tests, both in the Torah. One is in Devarim 13, the other one is in Devarim, Deuteronomy 18. These tests were established by God, not only to evaluate whether or not someone was actually speaking for him or lying, but also to consider the consequence of such assertions. And while we will delve into both, again, we've hinted at them already, but in subsequent months as we move through this material, and also in our conclusion of this material, we will delve into them in great detail. As a matter of fact, if you just want to jump ahead, you're welcome to go to questioningpaul.com, and you'll find it in the 3rd and 12th chapters of the book, a detailed presentation of Yahweh's test, as well as how Paul failed them. So Yahweh reveals that the best way to know who isn't speaking for him is to know what he has said. And so, if you want to judge Paul, you first have to know Yahweh. I look forward to being with you tomorrow.